Good morning and welcome to Behind the Headlines. This program is a weekly roundup of Utah news from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. Live every Friday morning and heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, state epidemiologist Dr. Angela Dunn announces that she's leaving the Utah Department of Health. A draft audit recommends changes to some practices of the Salt Lake City Police. And the Utah Supreme Court considers a question central to the future of the Utah Inland Port. Joining me for this conversation, we've got Salt Lake Tribune reporter Leah Larson. Good morning, Leah. Thanks for making time.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Of course. And let's see, reporter Taylor Stevens, welcome to you. Good morning.
Good morning.
And news columnist Robert Gerke, good morning and welcome to you, Robert.
Hey, good morning, Roger.
Listeners, you can join this conversation with your questions or comments. You can tweet to @KCPW or call 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. A story about a central figure in the state of Utah's pandemic response. Leah Larson, Dr. Angela Dunn, our state epidemiologist, will, as I mentioned, be leaving the Utah Health Department. Where is she going and when is that happening?
Yes, she is leaving for the Salt Lake County Health Department. She'll be replacing Gary Edwards, who is retiring in July after about 15 or 16 years as executive director. And her effective date, I believe, is in June. So a little bit of overlap.
Just to cut to the meat of the story here, Leah, why is Dr. Dunn leaving the state health department? Or do we know the whys here?
I think right as of right now, the only one who really knows is Dr. Dunn. But she did kind of have a bumpy year during the pandemic. It was leaked, you know, when she was giving out some blunt public health advice that maybe the governor at the time wasn't too happy with it. And there were some rumors that maybe her job wasn't secure. There were also some anti-maskers who doxed her address and showed up at her home to protest. So I have no idea if that's why she's leaving, but it, there's some speculation.
Sure. Did Dr. Dunn say anything officially about why she's going? It sounded like maybe the announcement was a bit of a surprise announcement, or at least that it caught some people off guard when it came out.
Yeah, so we've been hearing rumors about this for about a week, but we could never get it confirmed. But Dr. Dunn herself sent out an email this week to her staff at the State Health Department making the announcement, and we got a copy of one of those emails, and that's how we were able to find out.
Dr. Dunn had, you talked about the speculation for the reasons that she may be leaving. She had, in addition to facing some... You know, the residents who had differences of opinion with her about health measures being put in place. She also had herself. She had some differences of opinion with the state's coronavirus response at times. Is that safe to say? Meaning that the administration of Governor Gary Herbert wasn't necessarily always on the same page as some health officials, including Dr. Dunn.
Yeah, I think that's safe to say. I think that's also a trend that sort of played out nationwide in some states where public health experts were clashing with sort of the powers that be, the government officials making the decisions. And certainly Utah was among those states.
Okay. And then we know, as you know, again, that there were residents who... Robert Gerke, you wrote about this, who protested in front of her home, and who knows what kind of impact that sort of vitriol that she faced and pretty regularly might have had. You could imagine that might have had something to do with her leaving, and who wants to face that in their job. But we talked about those differences of opinion, Robert, that she may have had with state leaders over the, you know, over the strength of public health measures or maybe the lack of strength. I don't know where I'm going with this. Robert Gerke, news columnist for the Salt Lake Tribune, help me out. Do you want to talk about those, the various nuances, I guess, of Dr. Dunn's job, sure. and how she dealt with them?
I mean, inevitably, there's going to be tension between, the recommendations of public health people and then the politicians, and especially in this case, the legislature that was very resistant to, additional restrictions that might damage the economy. So while Dr. Dunn's focus was exclusively on saving lives, preventing the spread of the virus, these politicians had other agendas, we could say. And so, yeah, there's inevitably going to be tension there. I don't think it was any secret that, you know, there were times where, you know, the politicians erred on the side of keeping things open. And so it's a natural tension. I think, to her credit, I mean, I think she navigated it quite well. I mean, she was a team player throughout in terms of, you know, when the decision was made, she would explain to the public what the decision is, why it was being made, and what they needed to do in response. And I think her as a messenger throughout the pandemic, she was the most trusted authoritative source of information for Utahns, for the media in particular. And so, you know, that's her service in this role throughout the past 14 months of this pandemic has really been critical. And there are some who maybe would think, oh, well, she should have said more, she should have been louder, she should have quit, you know, in protest if things didn't go her way. But, you know, I think it was important that she remain where she was during this past year, because she was that trusted voice in the room where it happens, as they say. So I think, I think she did a terrific job. The only thing she's done to address why she's leaving was when she said yesterday during the news conference, sort of unprompted, I think, that she was not fired. And Governor Cox reiterated that she was not fired. This has been something, this vetting process at the county has been in the works for some time. Leah can probably say more specifically, but I think it's been a few months that they've been interviewing candidates. And so while it may seem abrupt, it's something that's been in the pipeline for a period of time.
Yeah. And Leah, Robert Gerke there mentioned the fact that Dr. Dunn really did become the face of, you know, the voice of science in the state of Utah for a period of time. And then he mentioned, dispelling rumors that she was fired or, you know, directly addressing the concept that may have happened. How has, just before we go into the Salt Lake County vetting process, how has Governor Cox responded to Dr. Dunn's announcement? What has he said about her pending departure, Leah Larson?
I think he kind of joked that he was going to issue a resolution saying she couldn't leave. I think he was very gracious and thankful for her work and her sort of being, again, that public face of the pandemic, that reassuring public face.
I guess a question that I have is, I wonder if she was expecting something different from the Cox administration than she had seen from Governor Gary Herbert. But Cox, of course, was the governor's lieutenant governor. In terms of the response to the pandemic, I guess this is all just wild speculation on my part, and I have no idea. But I'm going to quickly remind listeners to join this conversation. Tweet to @KCPW, or you can call in 801-355-8255. How have you viewed Dr. Dunn's role in Utah's pandemic response? Again, @KCPW or 801-355-8255, that we won't be on the story all that much longer. Leah Larson, this next job that she's going to with Salt Lake County Health Department, we can talk about, you know, the fact that there was a process in place to try and find a new director of that department. But I'm just curious, the role there, is it the same thing that she was doing before at the Utah Health Department, just at a different level, or is it a different job altogether?
It seems like it's a different job altogether, because she will be at the helm of the entire health department, overseeing everything from, you know, the coronavirus response and vaccinations to, you know, restaurant inspections. So different job.
Right. Different job. And then,
Roger,
yeah, sure. Go ahead. Robert Gerke.
I mean, I think one of the things that is probably attractive to Dr. Dunn about this, and this is speculation on my part, I guess, but, and I wrote about this in my column, is that, you know, she's usually, when she was giving these corona briefings, she was very kind of buttoned down in just the facts. And when she starts talking about health disparities, access to health care for underserved populations, you can really kind of see her get a little fire on that issue. And so I think that's an area in particular where, you know, you go to the most diverse county in the state and you're going to have some real opportunities to do some good there. And I think that's probably something that was you know, an enticement for her to go have some hands-on control over it.
Robert, just since you're a news columnist who can who's a, an opinion columnist to an extent, I'm wondering if you can talk about, will her departure impact the state of Utah's coronavirus response? I mean, there's been just this week at the governor's coronavirus news conference, he mentioned the fact that demand for vaccinations has been dipping and that we've hit a kind of plateau in coronavirus cases, a plateau after a decrease in cases. But we want to see it keep going downward, of course. Is this a tough time for the state to lose its, our state epidemiologist?
Yeah, I mean, there's probably never a good time, but I mean, we're with this law that the legislature passed, given the metrics that they put into that law and sort of the trigger rescinding most public health orders, a lot of the ability of the state health department to do anything in response to the pandemic for these final months is going away. I mean, it's going to be, obviously, like you referenced, the push to get people vaccinated, but the role of the public health department at this point is kind of winding down as a result of this legislation. So there's hopefully, as long as we don't see another spike, her role would probably be less and less at the forefront, if I
sure.
put that correctly.
Fingers crossed. Another thing that I wanted to ask you about, Robert Gierke, in your column, you wrote about the vitriol she faced. And, I think that there was a lot of goodwill out there early on in the pandemic, for first responders and frontline workers and people in hospitals and healthcare officials, health services officials like Dr. Dunn, and people in essential jobs. And there was gratitude directed towards them in those early months. But then in some instances, that kind of drowned out by, the antagonism from people who, for whatever reason, were averse to what the science was telling us. Do you want to talk about that sort of aspect of what she had to face?
Yeah, I mean, I think because, as Leah mentioned, and as I mentioned, she was such a public face for this coronavirus response, she became a public target for the people who objected to the measures they were taking. Mask mandates is something as simple as that. And so we ended up getting protesters at her home, which you got to keep in mind. I mean, she's a mother of a couple young kids. It's not a pleasant thing to have to deal with that. And, you don't know if these people are just angry or if they're potentially violent. You don't want to expose your children to that. And so, that had to be a really trying time for her. And it was completely undeserved and unwarranted that she would be the focal point of that, because it wasn't her decision. She didn't make the decision. She made recommendations to the governor. And so for a public servant who doesn't really have decision-making authority to be targeted like that and singled out and the focal point of that kind of vitriol, I think was really inappropriate and undeserved.
You say that, she was this careful communicator throughout and that in the end, we can say that she saved a lot of lives. Leah Larson, going back to you on the reporting end of this, I mean, I guess I don't know what to ask you. Have we exhausted this story or is there anything to add here?
I think that Gierke came in with a good assist.
Fantastic.
I don't have anything else to add.
Okay. That is government reporter Leah Larson. And we've also been hearing from news columnist Robert Gierke. Leah covered this for the Salt Lake Tribune. And that's it. We'll take a quick break on the show. And then when we come back, we will turn to the court case before the Utah Supreme Court over the Utah Inland Port. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be back in just a minute.
Hey, it's Luke Burbank. This week on the Livewire House Party, comedian Cameron Esposito on how she almost became a priest. Writer Ross Gay on finding one thing to delight in each day. And speaking of delightful things, we'll also have some music from The Lone Bellow. Don't miss this week's Livewire House Party from PRX.
Tomorrow evening at 5 on UPR.
On last week's Wait, Wait, Josh Gondelman explained why Starbucks is thriving during the pandemic while Subway is not.
Nobody's ever like, don't even talk to me till I've had my Italian cold cut combo in the morning.
Yeah. I'm Peter Sagal. Get your juices flowing with us as we talk to Broadway superstar Andre DeShields on this week's News Quiz from NPR.
Tomorrow morning at 9 on Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I am joined by Salt Lake Tribune reporters Leah Larson and Taylor Stevens, and by news columnist Robert Gerke. It's our live Friday morning Utah News Review, and you can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255 or tweeting to at KCPW. Taylor Stevens, we will go to you now, and a story that you are well versed in, the Utah Inland Port. The Utah legislature back in 2018, I believe, essentially annexed a big chunk of Salt Lake City's land when it created the Inland Port. Salt Lake City, back in the administration of Jackie Biskupski, said, hang on a minute, and filed a lawsuit. That suit is now at the state Supreme Court. What is this case all about, Taylor Stevens?
Yeah, I think it's helpful to start with what this case is not about, and it is not about whether there will be an inland port in Salt Lake City. The outcome of this case will not make that call. What the outcome of this case will decide is who gets to control the tax and land use authority over this chunk of land, which is about one-fifth of Salt Lake City's overall land. So really, who gets to make the decisions about how this area develops? And again, I think there's a lot of confusion. This is private land. And so the port doesn't own the land necessarily, but is able to sort of pull some of the strings as far as how the tax dollars are used, who gets deals for tax breaks with the government, and also has made some decisions around zoning that the city doesn't really have the ability to change at this point. And so that's what this lawsuit and the outcome will mean ultimately.
Okay. So what it's about and what it's not about there. Taylor Stevens, how did this case get to the Utah Supreme Court?
Well, as you mentioned, former Mayor Jackie Biskupski had initially filed suit against the Utah Inland Port and the state, basically alleging that this was an illegal, land grab. And that went to Third District Court and didn't turn out the way that the city administration, at least, had wanted it to. The court did side with the state in that case. And so this was actually one of Mayor Erin Mendenhall's first big decisions that she had to make when she was inaugurated last year. Shortly after she took the oath of office, she did decide to appeal this case to the Supreme Court. And of course, we know with the pandemic that the court system has been, in some ways ground to a halt and sort of starting to get back going. So it took more than a year for this case to get from appeal to actually getting oral arguments, which is what we had on Wednesday.
And I'd like to talk about, about the arguments that were made there. But there's this part of the crux of this is this section of the state constitution that's called the Ripper Clause. What is that and why does it have such a big bearing on this case?
Yeah, this is one sentence in the Utah Constitution that prohibits the legislature, and I'll just kind of quote from the Constitution here, from delegating to any special commission, private corporation, or association the power to make, supervise, or interfere with municipal improvement, money, property, or effects, to levy taxes, or to perform any municipal functions. So basically, at its core, this is a piece of the Constitution that gives some rights to cities to be able to, have their local decision making, not be interfered with.
And so, okay, well, that gets us to the court case itself. And you mentioned the fact that it's not about whether or not the court, the Inland Port, it comes into being or exists or will exist, but it is about who controls, that land use and taxing authority, who basically benefits from the taxes that are reaped by this parcel of land. And And this is on Salt Lake City's west side. It's not that far from the Great Salt Lake. I know there are environmental concerns as well, but I guess the question that I have before we jump into those arguments being made by different attorneys, if the city did win this case, would they essentially take control of the port, Taylor?
Yeah, and you know, it would just be much like the way that the city approves projects now, that those would go through sort of the normal process. And you know, the port says that all of these deals will have to go through the normal process, but they basically hold the key to the tax differential. So this is an area that's going to be difficult to develop for a variety of reasons. You know, there's not a lot of infrastructure out there, although there is more now that the state prison is going up. And so the businesses that want to come here are going to have to put a lot of work in to sort of make that a reality. And they're going to want to use the, you know, kind of levers of government tax breaks to make that happen. And, you know, the reason that could be a positive thing for I don't know, the community, I guess, is that the property tax there will go up. And so there will be kind of a financial benefit, obviously. But the city wants the power to determine, you know, which corporations, which businesses are going to get these tax breaks to sort of move into this area. And how is this going to develop? How, you know, for example, the state has told the city that it can't keep natural resources from passing through the inland port area. And that's something, you know, maybe the city would look at doing and prohibiting the transfer of coal or oil. You know, it's not a guarantee that they would do that, but they would have the decision-making power, where right now they're not able to have kind of that self-determination in an area that makes up such a big portion of the city, as I mentioned, one fifth. And so that's really what this case is about. And it gets a little bit, you know, into the weeds of government policy, but really what this is who has the power to control the future of this land.
Can you talk about the, you know, what sorts of arguments were being made by city attorneys and by attorneys for the state, you know, before the Utah Supreme Court, and how were the justices on the court, you know, taking those arguments, Taylor?
Yeah, so, you know, the state's argument really comes back to sort of fending off this this argument from the city that this is a violation of the Ripper Clause. And so they're arguing, you know, these aren't municipal funds. They're saying, you know, the state has diverted the funds that the city otherwise would have had from property tax in this area. And so those are no longer municipal funds under the Ripper Clause. So that no longer applies. So we're not, you know, interfering. Or, you know, the inland port isn't a special commission, so that doesn't apply under the Ripper Clause. So basically they're going, you know, deep into many of the words that are in that section of the Constitution and sort of making an argument that, well, that doesn't apply here. You know, what we've done does not fall under that. And then on the, you know, the other end of the argument is Salt Lake City, which is saying, you know, that's exactly what they've done here. This is, you know, a special commission. These are municipal funds. These are municipal functions. So, for example, the zoning, they say, you know, the state has created mandates around zoning, and that's a municipal function. The state would say, you know, our mandate was limited. We're not actually involved in the day-to-day zoning decisions. That's still with the city. And so just really, again, getting into the weeds of that section of the Constitution. What are municipal dollars? What are municipal functions? What is zoning? When does it cross that line into, you know, actually taking over the day-to-day? So that was really the arguments that we saw. And then to your question about the, you know, the reaction from the Supreme Court, there was some pushback from the justices, particularly on the argument that these aren't municipal dollars under the Ripper Clause, as I mentioned. So the state is arguing that they have the power to redirect those funds before they get to the city and that they're therefore not city dollars. But the justices, a few of them kind of pushed back on that, arguing that, you know, it seemed like the state was saying that there's no such thing as municipal funds, was what Chief Justice Matthew Durant said. Justice Paige Peterson also noted, you know, that these dollars would have gone to the city if not for the legislation created that created the Inland Port. And she said, you know, your argument has to be more than it's not their money anymore because we took it from them. How is this not municipal money? And so, you know, this really gets deep again into those weeds of what municipal funds are, what a municipal function is, and that will be up to the court ultimately to parse those definitions and decide, you know, whether this was indeed a violation of the Ripper Clause or whether the state is within its rights to have come in and sort of, you know, made this mandate as it has.
You write that justices also questioned why Salt Lake City residents didn't have a choice about whether or not they would be participating in the Inland Port. While elected officials in other jurisdictions did get that choice, the satellite ports would have the option of opting in. Salt Lake City says that it's not being treated equally, and some justices seem to agree with that.
Yeah, and that's part of the argument as well from the state is that, you know, this inland port, they say, is going to rise all boats, that it's going to be good for the state at large, and that, you know, with such a big statewide benefit, it doesn't make sense for one city to really direct the way that this is going to develop. So that's part of their argument for saying this isn't a municipal purpose or a municipal function. But as you mentioned, you know, the justices did kind of question that a little bit, saying, you know, if there's a statewide benefit, why is Salt Lake City mostly bearing the burden of making sure that this port comes together? You know, why not levy a statewide tax that would support the development of the inland port? And so that was a piece of it. The other thing, and as you mentioned, that the satellite port elected officials have the option to opt in. And the attorneys for the state argue that there's no disparate treatment, that the land in Salt Lake City is a really, you know, vital location for making this happen, and that all cities that are part of the area currently are treated the same, and all of those that are not part of it are treated the same. So that's kind of their response, but that certainly was an interesting line of questioning from the justices. It will be interesting to see kind of where they go with that equal protection piece of this case.
You write that that the executive director of the Utah Inland Port, Jack Hedge, he wants this to be resolved as well. I mean, everybody involved in the case, I guess, probably wants it to be resolved because for him, it's about the uncertainty and that basically they're having a hard time moving forward with that uncertainty hanging over them.
Yeah, I think that for both sides, uncertainty is, you know, not ideal. So for the city, they're losing tax revenue. They're worried about the precedent that this could set. So they want it to be resolved quickly. As you mentioned, the port, they certainly want this to be resolved quickly. And I think that the ruling in their favor from the Third District Court was certainly a big win for them and sort of, you know, the legitimacy of the project, which has faced a lot of scrutiny and a lot of questions over the last few years. And so both sides really want to see this resolved quickly. However, I know the Supreme Court has many other cases on the docket that it has yet to rule on. So it's not really clear when we're going to see, you know, an opinion on this particular case. It could be a few months, it could be a few years. Wow. You know, I've reported on one case before the Supreme Court that we're still waiting on a resolution on years later. And so it's really hard to know how soon these issues could be resolved. One thing that is interesting that I will add is that, you know, many of the opponents of the port who don't want to see this built at all, they say that there are other legal avenues they could go down, you know, environmental claims that they could make, and that's not off the table. So even if this case were resolved, it's not a sure thing that it would all be settled.
This is a question, Taylor, that I ask you every time we talk about the Inland Port, but how much of it is, you know, has been built? How much of the, you know, the port area that was claimed by the state now has stuff on it?
I'm not sure percentage wise, but, you know, there is development that was green lighted even before the port passed this legislation in 2018. The legislature passed this legislation right in 2018 that is moving forward. So it's not like there is nothing on this land. However, there are distinctions in, you know, I would say more the northern boundary is less developed, and there are pieces that are going in all the time, right? So it's all kind of working through the process currently. And this will kind of just decide, you know, this court case, how what isn't built out will sort of continue to move forward.
I'm going to bring Robert Gierke, news columnist for the Salt Lake Tribune, in on this. And Gierke, I have to admit that I kind of forgot about this court case and the Ripper Clause. And, you know, it feels like the wheels have been in motion, and they have been, as Taylor just described. But the you know, the very birth of this thing is in the balance in this case. And, you know, who controls taxing authority? Yeah. I mean, had you forgotten? What do you think about this case? And Gierke, you're muted.
Sorry. I think Taylor summarized the issues really well. I think that she's, you know, this has been an issue that the city's been focused on from the get-go. It probably is the best opportunity for the city to, you know, shape the future of the port, you know, to actually have a more of a say in it. So it is a critical issue. I think the legislature early on made some changes to the inland port legislation to sort of limit their exposure to a Ripper challenge. They, you know, instead of taking all of the tax money out of it and requiring the city to, you know, provide utilities and police service and fire service, they're now contracting with the city, and the city's keeping a portion of the tax revenue. So those measures were taken because I think the legislature recognized that they could be vulnerable to a challenge under this. So, you know, it's gonna be a critical issue, and it's hard to kind of get a sense of where the justices are gonna go. As Taylor mentioned, there seemed to be some skepticism both ways, I think, and so we'll wait and see. And I think the other, you know, in terms of other challenges that might be out there, I think there continue to be some environmental challenges that might be brought forth to try to stymie the port. But this one is probably the big hurdle that the port has to overcome to, you know, move forward.
I kind of wonder if this, you know, assuming a loss for the state and a win for the city in this case, I wonder if the legislature could recreate the thing in a way that would avoid this kind of challenge. But I'm assuming.
Yeah, I mean, they've tried to tailor it in such a fashion that it's not going to be easily struck down, right? So they have taken some steps to try to, like I said, limit their exposure on this. So and yeah, I mean, if the court comes back and says no, you've gone too far, then I would think the likelihood would be that the legislature would try to carve out any objectionable parts of the port legislation and move ahead with it. They've already kind of got a lot invested in trying to get this off the ground.
Taylor Stevens, we haven't talked about the Westside community organizations concerned about air pollution or the environmental groups. I guess we did talk a little bit about the environmental groups that are concerned about, you know, the destruction of the ecosystem in wetlands and buffering areas leading out to the Great Salt Lake. Is this case something that those kinds of opponents, those who are concerned about the port, are involved in? I'm sure that they're watching, but are they actually involved in the case?
I wouldn't say involved. No, I would say that the city is really and the state are kind of shepherding this through. But as you said, I think certainly they're watching it. And, you know, there are some folks who just want to, you know, abort the port as sort of the refrain. But there are others who sort of see the port as an inevitability and just want to see it done in a really environmentally sensitive way. And the state, you know, the Inland Port Board has said that that's one of its goals. However, there are people who think that the city would be more likely to develop this in a way that was really environmentally sensitive. And so, you know, there are certainly some that, you know, regardless of the outcome of the port will continue trying, or of the case will continue trying to do what they can just to stymie this project altogether. Others, I think, would feel more at ease knowing that the city was shepherding this through. So again, just have to kind of wait and see what comes and what the reaction to it is ultimately.
And we don't really know the time frame there. Robert Gierke, any final comments? We were going to take another break here, just checking in with you.
No, I mean, I think we got it. It's definitely something to keep an eye on because, like I said, it probably is the city's best chance to have more of an influence on the direction this port takes. And so it's going to be an important issue to watch.
Taylor, did we cover everything on this story?
I think we have. Thanks.
All right. Perfect. Listeners, you're tuned to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio, featuring journalism from the pages of the Salt Lake Tribune. We're going to take a quick break and come back with a story that has some recommendations for Salt Lake City police after an audit. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on Utah Public Radio. Thanks for tuning in today. Coming up next hour, we have UPR Presents, that's Intelligence Squared today, followed by The Moth at 11 o'clock, and BBC programming beginning today at noon. Today for UPR Presents, it's Intelligence Squared on psychedelics.
Psychedelics, medicine, recreation, or sacrament.
Drugs have been used by all kinds of populations through all historical periods.
Opponents point to the unknown dangers of psychedelics and the lack of data on the effects of increased access.
There's no established methodology which shows how they should be used or what they should be used for.
Should we legalize psychedelics? That's next time on Intelligence Squared US.
This morning at 10 on Utah Public Radio.
That's
psychedelics, medicine.
That's coming up in 20 minutes.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Leah Larson, Taylor Stevens, and Robert Gerke. This is our Friday morning local news roundup. Join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK, or you can tweet to at KCPW. So this week in Minneapolis, a jury found former police officer Derek Chauvin guilty of the murder of George Floyd, an incident that launched nationwide protests that killing and sustained, you know, launched some sustained movement for changes to how police in the United States operate in the communities that they serve. Just as that verdict was coming down, or just afterwards, actually, an audit looking at police practices here in Salt Lake City came out. And Leah Larson, you did the reporting on this. Tell us what this audit found, and I guess maybe tell us about the audit itself and why it was undertaken first.
Yeah, so in a lot of ways, last summer feels like a lifetime ago for me. I don't know about you, but... Yeah. You know, there were almost nightly protests about police violence and as you mentioned, but also at the same time, people were calling into city council meetings, giving comments periods that lasted for hours, demanding right. that Salt Lake City Council cut $30 million from the police budget or even defund it entirely. Now, the council couldn't do that. They did remove a small portion of their budget and put it in a holding account. But they also responded by commissioning this audit to look at both the police department's finances as well as their operations. And completely coincidentally, as you mentioned, they released the draft findings the same day that the verdict came in for the George Floyd case. And there was a lot in there, but I'm happy to discuss some of the highlights if you'd like.
Sure. You break the findings of the audit down into various categories. Among them is the idea of closing mental health gaps. This is basically about who responds when someone is called out to to what is a mental health crisis. Tell us about what is recommended there in this audit. And also, maybe actually, who conducted this audit and what is their sort of expertise there? If you can talk about that too, Leah.
Oh, that's a great question. So the council has, I think, about four consulting groups sort of on retainer. And so they went to these four groups that they already have sort of a contract with and have put that out to bid to them. And they selected the group they selected is called Matrix Consulting Group.
Okay. They do audits like this. Can you talk about that mental health gap finding that changing how the police respond or someone responds when there's a mental health crisis?
Yeah, so I think this was at the forefront of a lot of people's minds. I you recall, there was an incident where officers shot and injured a 13-year-old autistic boy who was having a mental health episode. So this was an important issue to a lot of people, I think. And what this audit found is, I guess it feels sort of intuitive in retrospect, but basically there's this team called a crisis intervention team that is trained to respond to mental health issues, but they work a shift from about 6 a.m. to 4 p.m. And what the audit found was that a lot of these calls and these needs for mental health services come in the evening and overnight. So they recommended that the police department stagger its crisis intervention team's shifts, so they're available, you know, into the night and on weekends.
And that's just because that wasn't happening before, meaning that there weren't enough people when these mental health crises calls were coming in the evenings.
I don't know if it was not enough people, but maybe not the right people, if that makes sense.
It does. And you mentioned, you know, there's the three incidents that your article references. There's the shooting and injuring of a 13-year-old autistic boy while he's having a mental health episode. There's the police shooting death of Bernardo Palacios Carbajal. And then, and there's other incidents, but another part of this audit is that there's some recommended changes to body camera policy. I mean, basically, officer accountability is this next broad section. One of those has to do with body camera policy. Can you talk about that, Leah?
Sure. So the audit actually had some praise for the city's body-worn camera policy. Officers are apparently very good at activating their cameras when they're engaging with people. They properly turn them on 92% of the time, they found. So the police are supposed to do their own sort of internal audit of how well they're activating their cameras. And the audit found that they just weren't doing it quite enough. The police department is auditing those cameras about 5 times a month. And the auditors found that that was kind of low, and they recommend 20 audits a month of the cameras, and then also posting the findings of those audits online so the public can review them.
And that's okay. So that's a change, or that would be an additional change in policy. And then another part of the audit has to do basically with, you know, we talked about officer accountability, but financial transparency within the department. Can you describe that for us as well?
Yeah. Before I jump into that, though, I want to point out another finding that I thought was important with the accountability end. It's that.
Please do.
So when there's a complaint about an officer and the police department investigates, the audit found that if that officer quits or retires, they don't complete that investigation. So if that officer that's quitting decides to go to another department, you know, get another job somewhere else, the investigation isn't done. They don't have their findings. So they recommended that, you know, even if the police officer leaves the department, they should finish their investigation, because then at least they'll have that record.
And that is an important point to have brought up. That's interesting. And I guess that's the question that I have there is that actionable? Is that something that the police can say, you know, we won't allow a person to make that jump before an investigation is finished? Do you know what I mean?
You know, I don't think they have that kind of authority. I'm not sure, but I mean, if somebody wants to quit, I don't think they can say, no, you can't quit.
Right. Okay. And then on to the financial transparency side of this. This is a complicated part of your story, but it has to do with basically budgeting. Maybe you can tell us about this part, Leah.
Yeah. you know, budgeting can sometimes cause people's eyes to glaze over, and there's a lot of complex things in here. But I think the first thing to point out is that the audit did not find that the police department is mismanaging its budget or doing anything shady. But they did recommend. So to give you some context, what the city council ultimately wants to do is something called a zero-based budgeting exercise, where they sort of dismantle the entire police department budget and rebuild it back according to priorities. So they really have like a firm understanding of all its complexities. So in order to do that, this consulting firm recommended that the police department do a better job at coding some of its expenses and budget items. That way they can really do this zero-based budget exercise. They'll have like a firmer understanding of where all the money is going, and that they also keep a better sort of tracking mechanism of its short-term contracts.
And there were, just to close this out, Leah, there were some city council members who were laudatory of the audit, and they want to see changes. I'm wondering, on that exercise, you know, is it just an exercise of unbuilding and then rebuilding, or is it an actual unbuilding and rebuilding of the police budget?
So I think this piece is ultimately how the council is trying to answer those calls to, you know, quote unquote, defund the police or to scrutinize a budget. This is their answer to that, but it's going to be a long process. I spoke to Council Chair Amy Fowler, and she thinks it will take, you know, they'll be able to conduct it over the coming year. Their budget period is just, you know, the city, their budget is not a calendar year. It begins in June. So that's just starting. And over this coming fiscal year, they're going to be really looking at that and conducting their budgeting exercise.
Got it. Robert Gricke, news columnist, is there anything you want to say about this? I mean, an audit recommending changes for police departments. Of course, this is coming the same day as massive news, the you know, finding of guilty on all counts of Derek Chauvin in the murder of George Floyd. I guess, yeah. Those two things related at all?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think we can safely say that the murder of George Floyd and the backlash surrounding that sort of prompted this, and I think it's a good thing. I think it's a healthy thing that departments are are being a little introspective and having outside eyes assessing their strengths and weaknesses, and hopefully other departments follow suit, and you know, put these reforms into place. I think it's a valuable exercise that we probably wouldn't be seeing were it not for, you know, the protests the last summer and the murder of George Floyd. I will add, you asked about officers that leave departments. Yeah. Under a bill that passed the legislature last session, those officers that leave the departments, the departments that will still finish the investigations, so they can kind of follow the officer a little bit. They can't just jump from one department to another. So that's a good thing. I mean, Governor Cox signed a dozen police reform bills that passed the session, or a ceremonial signing this week. But I think the ceremony is worthwhile, just because it drives home the point that, you know, that we're taking some at least baby steps toward police reform, and these departments are, you know, under a little bit of scrutiny now.
Okay. Yeah, I had meant to turn the conversation now to some other reporting from this past week's news, but we're running up against the clock. And so, Leah, I'll ask you this perfunctory question, which is, are we missing anything from this story?
I think the only other thing I'd toss in is that the audit also found that about 14,000 calls to the department could have been handled by like a civilian officer, a civilian responder. So they recommended hiring more of those as well.
And that's an interesting point. Just the idea that in some responses you wouldn't necessarily need a use of force response where the assumption is that there's danger as you go in.
Yeah, correct.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, some interesting recommendations from an audit, and thanks for your coverage, Leah Larson, on this story and everything else you've been covering. With that, though, we are going to have to turn to our final segment of the show, the underplayed stories of the week. And Taylor Stevens, we've had you on mute for quite a while. Let's bring you back into the conversation, and I'll ask you to start to kick us off with a pick for underplayed story of the week.
Yeah, we've talked a lot about homelessness on the show, including the changeover from the downtown Road Home shelter, which closed to make way for three new homeless resource centers in the Salt Lake City area. And my colleague Bethany Rogers reported this week that developers have unveiled the plans for what will be built on the land where the Road Home's old downtown emergency shelter once was. And it's going to be a 7-story apartment complex. And and it would not have the type of housing that it would need in order to be affordable to some of the folks who had previously stayed and been living in the old road home shelter. And so this has kind of been long predicted by advocates who have felt that business interests were trying to push the homeless out of the neighborhood, and we're sort of seeing the culmination of that now.
That was almost, you could have almost said, I bet you can guess what's going in there. Taylor Stephens, thanks for your pick for Underplayed Story of the Week. Let's go to Robert Gerke, news columnist. What's your pick, Robert?
D. Michael Quinn is a preeminent Mormon historian for right. many, many decades, published these authoritative histories of the church, and was later excommunicated by the church because of they didn't like some of what he wrote. He passed this week. The causes are undisclosed, but there's a really great reflection on his life and his impact at sltrib.com that you can read today.
Check it out at sltrib.com. Thank you for that pick for Underplayed Story, Robert Gerke. Leah Larson, we will go to you now for a pick for Underplayed Story of the Week.
Yeah, my underplayed story pick is by our education reporter, Courtney Tanner. So a middle school in Provo assigned its students to be fictional slaves and plantation owners, which itself sounds pretty problematic. But when the parents of a Black student protested this, the teacher said that student could play a person from the North instead of the South. And then when more parents kind of raised concerns about this, the teacher said if the students didn't want to participate, they could instead read a book about a white family's experience in the Civil War and then write a report on it. So all kinds of problematic things happening there.
Strange. That's an interesting story that Courtney Tanner, that was Courtney Tanner's reporting, is that correct?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, check out Courtney's reporting on that at sltrib.com. It's very interesting and kind of baffling, to tell you the truth. Thank you, Leah, for that pick for Underplayed Story. This this is a story that's a couple of weeks old, and I had meant to say something last week but ran out of time, and it is that Salt Lake Tribune government and politics editor Dan Harry has left the paper. Over the years, a few reporters randomly told me that they had come on board to work at the paper specifically to work with Dan and to learn from his expertise. And, I'm personally a fan of editors, of section editors at any newspaper, because they play a role that I think readers sometimes overlook, which is that they guide reporters' coverage, of course, and they fact check and do all of that. But they also sometimes protect reporters from themselves. And I don't know if... it's just an interesting thing that I think, needs to be recognized. And that's a key part of their job. Anyway, Dan was good at that. He was good at all of his job. And I think that yet another Tribune goodbye, and I'll miss having Dan Harry on the show as well. So,
Roger, if yeah. I could. I mean, Dan was my editor for 14 years, and he was not just a terrific reporter during his time. He was a terrific mentor, and I think we're going to miss him tremendously.
Okay. Thanks very much, Robert, for that. And fond farewell to Dan Harry. You've been listening. But first off, Taylor Stephens, Leah Larson, Robert Gerke, all with Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah. You have been listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW from the Salt Lake Tribune, and featuring reporters and editors from that paper and columnists. You can find podcasts at kcpw.org. Find everything we've been covering over at sltrib.com. I'm Roger McDonough. Join us again next week.
For more statewide news here on Utah Public Radio, tune in for Access Utah Monday through Thursday at 9, and on Thursday mornings at 10 o'clock, we have Both Sides of the Aisle. And for any more news coverage, you can tune in this afternoon from 3 to 6:30 for All Things Considered here on Utah Public Radio. Thanks for listening this morning to Behind the Headlines. Utah Public Radio is a statewide, member-supported service of Utah State University and the College of Humanities and Social Sciences. KUSR Logan, KUSK Vernal, KUSL Richfield, KUST Moab, KCEU Price, KUSU FM Logan, also heard at upr.org and on the UPR app. UPR Presents is up next with a special Intelligence Squared episode on psychedelics. That's followed by The Moth at 11 o'clock.